This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Two guests join us for the program this afternoon. Both are writers and both are members of the James Jones Literary Society. Our guests are Kaylee Jones, the daughter of James Jones, and Ray Elliott. They join us a couple of days ahead of the 16th Annual Symposium of the James Jones Literary Society. The symposium is this Friday and Saturday, the 10th and 11th of November, at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. It will include showings of a number of films, including three feature films. Two of them are adaptations of the James Jones novels. They are of James Jones novels. They are From Here to Eternity and The Thin Red Line. The third film, which kicks off the symposium Friday evening, is A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries. It is an adaptation of Kaylee Jones's novel of the same title. The James Jones Literary Society Symposium is free and open to the public. However, there is an admission charge for the three feature films that will be screened. Our guest, Kaylee Jones, is the author of five novels and a screenplay. In addition to A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries, her novels include Celeste Ascending and Speak Now. Ray Elliott is the author of a novel and a novella. Wild Hands Toward the Sky was his first novel, and Iwo Blasted Again. That is just out now from Tales Press. It is the novella, and it is about surviving war and being haunted by the memories of combat. Memory is a theme of that novel, I think I would say. Listeners, I look forward to your phone calls this afternoon. We're going to talk about the symposium, and we're going to talk about veterans and soldiers and writing. Any of these topics, if you've got a question or comment to make, join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Kaylee?
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
It's good to talk with you again. And Ray, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Both of you have been guests on the program before. Never yes. together, though.
No, we haven't.
So welcome. It's good to talk with you again, both of you. Kaylee, maybe you would start us out here talking a little bit about the goals of the James Jones Literary Society.
Well, I think the original idea was to gather people who had an interest in his work and people who'd known him before everybody got too old, it seems. I mean, there were many people who'd known him in Illinois who had sort of lost contact with him over the years, and there were scholars and professors from different universities across the United States who were interested in his work. So we started just as one afternoon of everybody getting together, and then at that night at the dinner it was voted upon that we should begin a society. And for me, really, the main reason that I got involved and wanted to stay involved was for the James Jones First Novel Fellowship, which is a grant every year, which is now up to $10,000, which we donate to an unpublished first novel. I'm one of the judges and also one of the chairmen on that committee, but I'm one of the judges who picks the novel each year. There are three judges right now. Sometimes there are four or five. But right now we're at three. It's a lot of work, but it's one of the great pleasures of my year. You know, picking the winner and getting to call that person up and announcing, you know, this prize. It started out as much less at I think 1,500 when we first put this together, and now it's up to 10,000 because of donations and several benefactors that we have who've given money for this prize. Don Sackrider is one of the benefactors who was a member of the renowned Loney Handy Colony in Marshall, Illinois, who's become a great friend to me personally and a great friend to the society. And the other was another member of the society who'd kind of vanished from sight, who ended up leaving in his will a fairly large sum of money for the purpose of helping another young writer with a novel in progress. So we've had great success with this, and I think that's one of our, besides promoting the works of James Jones and promoting scholarship and discussion on his works, we also are promoting hope for struggling first-time novelists.
Yeah, and helping young writers was very important to your father.
Yes, it was, and I think this was something he would be very proud of, very happy with, this fellowship. I mean, we've, out of the last 13 or 16, I think it's only, I'm not sure, 15 years, I believe, we've had the yearly fellowship. I believe 11 of the novels or 12 of the novels have been published to critical acclaim. That's a very, very high percentage.
Yeah.
And that's the best news of all, is that we're actually getting attention for these novels that we choose, and most of them have found a publisher, and they're not necessarily easy sells either.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah.
That's
very
terrific.
Literary, very intelligently written, wonderful novels, and they've all gotten, they've almost all, except for a couple which were not finished, I believe. I think maybe only two have not found a publisher yet.
Yeah. Ray, will this year's winner be on hand?
Yes.
At the symposium?
Herta Feely from Washington, D.C. will be here and will do a reading, and Kaylee and Don Sackrider will present the $10,000 to her at the Virginia on Saturday morning.
Yeah. That's terrific. Kaylee, tell us about your father and his belief in young writers and how he went about helping them during his lifetime.
Well, first there was the colony in Marshall, mm-hmm. which I think was set up as a bunch of cabins. I think the Handys at first put up the money, and I believe he was the first member of the colony. You know, he wrote under the tutelage of Loney Handy and also under the financial support of her husband, Harry. He wrote From Here to Eternity there, I think, in their house, pretty much in Marshall. And then after he had success with that, you know, Loney always wanted to open this writer's colony, and they sort of invited people, applied, young writers applied and came and lived there. And after that, when he left Illinois and moved to France, he was always available to young writers. People always came and asked him for advice or help, and he put himself out more than you'd think, more than you'd expect from someone as well-known at the time as he was, and also, you know, as successful and as busy. And he always seemed to have some young writer around who needed help. And I, it's very sweet, because in the letters of James Jones, which were put together by George Hendrick and Mike Lennon, I believe, there's a wonderful letter that he wrote to a general that he met in Vietnam whose son wanted to be a writer. And he writes this great letter to this general explaining that, look, if your son wanted to be a doctor, you know, you would pay for 4 years of college and 3 years of graduate school for that person to be a doctor. He said, well, it's the same thing with somebody wanting to be a writer. They need the same support, but it's just that at the end of the road, there isn't that guarantee that they're going to make back all that money. And it might be less respectable to a certain degree to be a writer, but it's the same amount of work and the same amount of time. And it was just so sweet, you know, that he was trying to get the guy to give his son some money, you know. And of course, the kid was a hippie, and the dad was, you know, a general in the army. So it's a very sweet letter, and I always think about that letter when I think about helping a writer, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now you're a writer, and Ray's a writer, and I've got a question for you that I think is one of the great questions that you can ask a writer: is why. Why does someone write? I can see helping.
Oh,
I'll write you a check at the end of the hour. But you know, why do you write? Why did your dad write?
Well, my dad wrote because he had a burning need to write. I think his need to write was fueled by rage at the injustice that he'd experienced in the war, and having killed somebody in hand-to-hand combat, and having survived Guadalcanal, I believe he really felt he had something to write about. I think he would have written anyway, but because he was already a writer before Pearl Harbor, before he ended up in Guadalcanal, he desperately wanted to write. He'd found his calling. He just didn't quite have the subject yet that he'd, you know, mm-hmm. would cultivate and write about for the rest of his life, pretty much. But the young letters are interesting because he talks about that, about wanting to write and what he's interested in and what he's interested in writing about. And then he survived the war, and that gave him the sort of impetus for all the rest of his writing. And I think Ray understands this as a soldier or Marine himself, that there's no experience like the experience of coming from a family that's devastated by loss in the war, or by a parent who is in the war, or a family that's military, you know, how much that can affect your entire life. It certainly affected mine to have a father who is a veteran. And, you know, I think that was what drove him, a kind of sort of slow-burning rage. And it's funny, because Larry Heineman, the Vietnam writer who's a National Book Award winner, once said, I heard him say that to a panel or in a discussion. He said, you know, if it's not something that you would fight to the death over, don't even think about writing about it, because if you don't care enough to fight to the death over it, nobody else is going to care about what you have to say. And I thought that was very telling, because I think you can really feel it when you read a book where the writer is passionate and truly dedicated to the theme and to the cause, whatever it is in the book.
And let's bring Ray in here now. Iwo blasted again. Tell us about this novel. What led you to write it?
Well, I was looking for something to write, and I went to the 59th annual Iwo Jima reunion in New Orleans with some kind of a cockamamie idea about what I wanted to write, knowing that Iwo Jima had been written about so much. And I spent a couple days over here when I came back in the intensive care unit and became familiar with sundowners, elderly people who have a problem. It's often associated with Alzheimer's patients, but during this time it can be any elderly person with sleep deprivation or any other number of issues. In the middle of the night, they seem to hallucinate and have flashbacks and so forth. And I know that combat affects people after, you know, for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I put this man and talked to a number of Iwo Jima veterans and went to Iwo Jima for the 60th reunion of honor there, and came back with the idea and sat down and wrote it. It's the last 36 hours of the man's life, and it sort of captures the essence of what he went through during his lifetime. And I don't think, as Kaylee said, her father or any other combat veteran ever forgets, and it affects him for the rest of their lives. So I wanted to, I really wanted to share that with people who haven't been there or haven't had a family member there, and to really let people know what we put our young men and women in harm's way and how it's going to affect them.
Yeah, and let's back up a little bit here, and maybe Ray, you would talk about, you know, why it is you write. Kaylee touched on her experience a little bit, but she talked more about her father. Mm-hmm. Tell us about why you write. What led you to pen and paper years ago?
My father was quite a reader, and I always saw him reading, so I picked up the reading habit for him. And then when From Here to Eternity came out, I mean, it caused such a splash in Robinson, Illinois, and well, all over the country as far as that goes. And I just thought it was something that I wanted to do. I mean, some people want to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, and I just wanted to write because of the connection with literature and sharing your stories with people.
Hmm. And Kaylee?
Well, for me, it was really the death of my father, I guess. For me, that was the real sort of first major horrific and absolutely, you know, unbearable experience of my life. And I think I spent a long time after that trying to just survive it, try to work it out. He was really the person I was closest to in my family. And the loss of him at that age, at 16, was just, yeah. You know, it's going to be 30 years May 9th, which is really, he would have been 85 on November 6th, which is a couple days ago. And my daughter's going to be 9 tomorrow, so it's all very close together, close to Veterans Day. But anyway, his death was my inner war, I guess, and that was what got me started writing, a kind of rage at that and a need to express it. And I think reading Tolstoy in college, I had this epiphany, you know, this revelation that across you know, several, you know, 100 years or more, this man, you know, was writing about the experience of death in a way that, that was so close to what I'd experienced in losing my father that I felt that, that he was actually speaking to me, you know, Tolstoy. And I said, my God, if this guy can reach across more than 100 years and help me survive this, get through this, then there's really something to say about this writing thing. You know, that's what I felt. And I still feel that way about Tolstoy.
What a difference a book can make, huh?
Amazing. And if you talk to writers, each writer will tell you a different book that did that to him or her. And, you know, many children of veterans across this country have said to me when they find out who I am that their only connection with their father in terms of war stories or in terms of their father, World War II veterans, experience in the war was through my father's books. Hmm. And that's one of the most moving experiences that I've ever had as the daughter of James Jones, is to have young men come up to me, and say, you know, my father refused to talk about the war, whether they were in the Pacific or in the, you know, in the Western Front, it doesn't really matter. But they would say, you know, my father wouldn't talk about the war. Mm-hmm. And then one day I asked, you know, Daddy, can you tell me about the war? And they basically handed them the Thin Red Line, you know, and From Here to Eternity, and said, this is the war. And that's incredible.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Kaylee Jones is our guest this afternoon. Also, our guest, Ray Elliott. Both are writers and both are members of the James Jones Literary Society. Listeners, this is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Speaking of stories, I'm going to turn to Ray Elliott now again. And at the outset of Iwo Blasted Again, you acknowledge the stories of a couple of veterans, mm-hmm. who you got to know. Bill Madden, one of them, Ben Correll. Tell us about them.
Well, I grew up with Ben Correll in Oblong, Illinois. I mean, one of my first memories, I think, was of Ben. And he had been wounded at the base of Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima the day before the flag raising there. And a lot, as Kaylee said, a lot of World War II veterans did not want to talk about the war. But I was a little kid, and I was running around with my father and other people, and I would hear people talk about the war. So I started asking a lot of questions. And I asked questions to Ben, particularly through the years, up until the point where when I was in the Marine Corps, I'd come back home and I'd go in and talk with him. And he would tell me about seeing the flag raising on Iwo Jima as he was hoisted up the side of the hospital ship. And he said, I looked back at that mountain there and saw Old Glory up there. And when he would tell me that, tears would start coming down in his eyes. And Bill Madden is one of the Marines that he was in the first wave on the landing at Iwo Jima with Easy Company, 2nd Battalion, 27th Marines. And he was an English teacher, too, and so I got a little closer to him because I taught English and journalism for a number of years. And Bill gave me, he opened his heart up to me and told me a lot of stories, and I fictionalized those to an extent in the book. But these people had gone through so much and had been a part of the historic, monumental invasion of Iwo Jima that is... you know, the flag raising in the Marine Corps Memorial keeps that in our mind, and of course, flags of our fathers now. But those two men had a tremendous influence on what I wrote, particularly in Eagle Blasted.
Yeah, and also there were some amazing letters, correspondence, and historical documents that you came across in the course of your research. You write in the acknowledgments about an alum of the University of Illinois, Dr. Luther Lowence, mm-hmm. if I've got the name correctly.
Lawrence, I think.
Lawrence. And he was one of the doctors treating the wounded of Iwo Jima, this Battle of the South Pacific that cost thousands of men their lives. And what he did was he had nurses give the wounded pencil and paper and said, you know, write down your experiences or write a letter. His idea was more or less to so that they would have something to do.
I think that was a part of it. I also suspected that it might be to keep something for posterity because these people hadn't been off of Iwo Jima just days or weeks. And he kept those for until he died, and his family, through the James Jones Literary Society, got a hold of me and asked me what if we might be interested in the letters. And I talked to Barbara Jones, who is also a member of the society. And we have the original manuscript of From Here to Eternity and a copy of the pistol and other Jones memorabilia are over at the Rare Book Room. So Barbara was interested in getting those letters, and there were some very interesting reflections and perspectives of what had happened to these men.
Yeah. Is this something that the Society might publish?
Well, it's the Rare Book Room owns the, them now. I don't know. You know, and some of these kids were 17 and 18, 19 years old, and they weren't the most articulate people in the world. But there were several. I think there were 50-some letters. And one of them, Dewey Norman, was just, he wrote a 12-page account of his experiences there, and it was just incredible.
Yeah. Would you read that? I have it here for you.
Sure.
This is a Marine sergeant, correct?
Yes, he was a Marine sergeant with the 24th Marines and the 3rd Marine Division. He says, "The sight that met my eyes as I set foot on the beach is one that I shall never forget. Dead Marines were so thick that we had to sidestep them in order to move forward. I have withstood heavy enemy bombardment that lasted all night on Saipan, but never have I seen men who died so violently. Men were blown to pieces, one leg here, an arm there, and strings of guts that were several feet long. These men had scarcely set first foot on the beach, but to us, this was a reminder that we would have to fight and pay in human lives and blood for each foot of this barren island."
And one of the themes of this book is memory, remembering, the duty to remember, the pain of remembering as well.
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, Bill Madden, for example, said he had dreams for years of getting caught behind enemy lines. And that was the worst fear, and he would wake up. I've talked to other people who were prisoners of war. Their memories would be escaping, and their wives would try to wake them up, and sometimes it wasn't the best thing to do. But they would be, their arms and legs would be moving, and they would be dreaming that they were behind enemy lines or a prisoner of war, and they were escaping.
My father dreamt that he was, all the time, that he was in a foxhole, I think, a very shallow foxhole on Guadalcanal, because he slept with, I think it was, he had a gun in a side, you know, right next to the bed and a knife under the mattress, and he slept like that. He couldn't sleep without him. And he, you know, often ended up on the floor. And he, you know, he always woke up. You couldn't sneak up on him. He was always half awake and talked in his sleep a lot. You know, I remember being little and being scared and getting in bed with my parents, with both of them, and all night long he would just talk, you know. It was very strange to be raised with that kind of, I mean, he was so fearless in life, and his night sweats were great. And he wasn't even on Guadalcanal that long, you know, and he had that response. You can imagine these guys on Iwo Jima who had survived and survived and survived to end up in that battle. And another thing is, there's a, I haven't seen the movie yet, the Flags of Our Fathers, because I have to work myself up to seeing these World War II movies. I get emotionally just devastated from them. But, you know, I think when my father was asked to work on The Longest Day, which is about the Normandy landings, he wrote the Omaha Beach scenes for that film, which I think the screenplay was written by at least four directors, one German, one French, one British, and one American. Four screenwriters, I mean, one director. And, you know, what he wrote was really quite amazing, and they said to him, Hollywood called him and said, you know, we can't put that in this. We can't have bodies blown apart and you know, the ocean red and the guts everywhere. you know, people will be upset. And he said, well, what do you think it was, a picnic? You know, he was horrified. And then finally, you know, many, many years later, it took, you know, Spielberg to make a film where the first, you know, 25 minutes of that film are as realistic as one could possibly get to what it would be like in a battle of that magnitude. But people just seem to glorify it and don't really think about, you know, the stuff that Ray just read, which is the real truth of it, I think.
Yeah. Are you talking about Saving Private Ryan?
I was talking about Saving Private Ryan in my, the movie that Spielberg made that
right.
really kind of addressed, I don't think it's a good movie, but I think that first 20 minutes are really incredible, that handheld camera stuff he did with people being blown up and legs flying off and the whole thing, you know, was what my father had in mind when he was asked to do the Omaha Beach scenes in 1961 for the longest day, and they just wouldn't hear of it. They said it'll upset people.
So how did your father feel about those movies?
About war movies?
Yeah.
He wrote a wonderful article once called Phony War Films, which was published, I think, in the Saturday Evening Post, but I'm not sure. Which, Ray, have you read that article?
I've read it. I it's either an Esquire or Saturday Evening Post, and I'm not sure which one.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a real attack on the war film in general, and the silliness of how war is portrayed in film. And, you know, there were films he loved where he felt that the violence was honest and you know, sort of approximating reality, but at that time there weren't many of them. For example, he thought MASH was the best movie he'd ever seen in his life.
Yeah.
He just couldn't believe it because they made humor of it, and it was very dark, but at least it was honest in terms of the bloodshed and the, you know,
Did he like the film version of From Here to Eternity?
He didn't as a young man. He didn't like it at first because he thought he was too close to the book, and he thought it was too far from the book. Back then they couldn't be they couldn't use the language that he used, and they couldn't make the whorehouse a whorehouse. They had to make it a club where men went to dance. You know, they couldn't really make it what it was. There were many things that had to be changed just because of the Hollywood censors. And that upset him. But years later, I saw it with him many years later. In fact, it was, I think, when Sergeant Schreiber was the ambassador to France, they had a party honoring my dad, and they showed the movie at a, you know, movie theater. And it was, I can't remember if it was a fundraiser or just, I don't know, it was a benefit of some kind. And my father was very proud, and he said, well, you know, it's really not a bad movie at all. And this was, you know, quite a few years later. So I think he ended up liking the film when he was able to separate himself far enough from the book to appreciate it for what it was.
Yeah. I would imagine he didn't care for the Thin Red Line that was made in the 60s.
No, you know, he really loved, there were two people in that film that he was very good friends with, Kierzelay and Jack Warden. And he really, you know, I think that was Jack Warden was in that film too. He really you know, liked them, and he spent a lot of time with Kierzelay trying to, you know, get him to play the part the way it needed to be played. And in fact, Kierzelay did a great job in that movie. And my father always maintained that. He said he did a fantastic job, but it just wasn't a really, the movie didn't know what it was or what it was trying to be. And it was the wrong terrain, and I mean, a whole lot of things were wrong with it. So, no, he didn't love the movie, but he really liked Kierzelay's performance in it.
Yeah, and now the 97, it's 1997, the adaptation.
98, I believe.
98,
and actually,
okay.
Ray went down to Queensland, Australia, to the set, and spent some time down there with the actors. I couldn't go because I was almost 9 months pregnant, so I was it was bad timing, to say the least, but, you know, those things can't be helped, so I didn't go.
Yeah. Is this the first time the Society's annual symposium has focused on film?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we have shown films before, but never as a whole, you know, as the whole theme of the event.
Yeah. Well, what do you think of the 98 film, The Thin Red Line?
Me?
Yeah.
Right. I love the film. I absolutely adore the film. I spent quite a bit of time with Terrence Malick before he started shooting, and also in New York, and then when my baby was born, we took her and went to California very well-traveled infant. You know, she's been on about 20 planes by the time she was 8 months old. You know, we went to L.A. several times, and we went on the ship when they did the scenes on the ship approaching the island. And, you know, I spent quite a bit of time, and he really, really was so concerned about getting everything right, you know, and it ended up being such a piece of poetry, that film, I think. It's an anti-war film, and I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, The Thin Red Line is an anti-war book. It really is. It's not a rah-rah war is great book at all.
Yeah. What do you feel, let me ask Ray a question here. The Thin Red Line, what do you think of the Malick adaptation?
Well, as Kaylee just said there, I think it's very poetic, and I like that aspect of it. Making a film about combat is an extremely difficult thing to do. I think Terrence Malick did a fantastic job in that respect, but it's still extremely difficult to show all the mm-hmm. blood and guts and what it really is. And that's the reason I like The Thin Red Line, the book, and it's a lot of combat novels that are realistic like that does not glorify war. I think it's just almost impossible to translate it into a movie, but Malick did a fantastic job at it.
The novel is really hard to surpass.
Mm-hmm.
The novel is a collective consciousness of these soldiers, and that's one of the things that really strikes me when I look at it again, is that he had about 150 pages of that book, and he threw it out. He burned it. The first 150 pages that he did were so technically precise and so absolutely almost medical in their precision that there was no kind of emotional heart behind the very painstaking details. This is what I was told anyway later. And he threw it out and burned it and started again. And when he started again, he started with the collective consciousness of C for Charlie as one long amoebic being, you know, on the ship that they thought as a whole, as a group. And interestingly, that became, in the first chapter of Whistle, his last novel, the we voice. We were shipped back, you know, and there's no specific we, it's just all of them, or one speaking for the whole. You know, we heard they were coming back, you know, we meaning, again, C for Charlie, the same group of men, a brotherhood, who'd sort of joined this brotherhood through bloodshed, you know, on Guadalcanal, who the old company they call themselves, you know, the ones who survived, who were there together. And, you know, and that's a very interesting thing, and I think this is true of all wars, including Vietnam. When people die and the company stops being the company, they don't let other people in the same way, you know.
Yeah.
There's not that feeling of brotherhood and comradeship, and the fact that you would die to help your friend the way that they did,
And well, this idea of brotherhood is really strongly portrayed, I think, in Ray's new book, Iwo Blasted Again.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that Ray, you know, knows a great deal about and has written about a lot in his other novel, too.
Yeah, tell us about the voices that come together, the characters that come together in Iwo Blasted Again. You've got the main character, and then you've got some of the folks, you've got memories of folks that he mm-hmm. served with, and his son. So you've got an intergenerational mm-hmm. element going there, generational.
Well, I think, and James Jones said it about as well as anybody else, that when all the ideological and philosophical aspects of war and why we go to war, we still fight for one another. I mean, the man on your right and the man on mm-hmm. your left. And I think that's what this man, Jack Britton, in the book feels. You know, he has survived, and he's got memories 60 years ago, but they're just as present in today's world. And those people are the real uh-huh. people. I mean, in one place in the book it says that, you know, these are the best friends a man will ever have, those people when they depend on one another on the right and left.
Yeah. I went to the web and did some research, and one of the things that I came across was I found some links, Kaylee, to your dad, to an interview that he did with a CBS radio person gosh, I can't remember now when it was, but I remember now he told the interviewer that war is the worst, the most evil human pursuit going. And then the interviewer said, but World War II was a war, essentially, the interviewer said, that had to be fought. It, you know, it's, Studs Terkel calls it, you know, the good war.
Right,
although,
right.
Although Studs will tell you, I don't mean war is good or that was a good war. But your dad said that it was, when you're being shot at, when your life is on the line, it's, you're not thinking about the cause.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of underlying everything in the Thin Red Line. There's a great deal of politicking going on. You know, the higher ups, the generals, the, you know, the higher echelon lieutenants and so forth. You know, like the poor little soldier who finds the Japanese sword, you know, the general's beautiful family heirloom sword. And it gets taken from him, of course, because the general wants it, and it, and they turn it into a, you know, a kind of advertisement for the army and how wonderful the army is, because look at this guy giving up the sword to the general and so forth, and why people get the Medal of Honor or don't get the Medal of Honor. And there's a fabulous scene when the lieutenant says to Sergeant Welsh, you know, who's really warden from Here to Eternity, it's the same character, he says, by God, Welsh, I'm getting you the Bronze Star for that move. And Welsh says, if you ever mention Bronze Star to me, gang, and it's God help me, I'll kick your teeth in, lieutenant or not. You know, he's just horrified. Like, I don't want your Bronze Star. This has nothing to do with bravery. This has nothing to do with, you know, in the moment of it, the way he behaved and saving this guy was just completely instinctive. He wasn't thinking about Bronze Stars or, you know, anything else.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that scene. And I, you know, there's so much politicking going on behind. And really, basically, the common foot soldier, which is what my father was, is fodder.
Well, and that's the thing, too. I think the combat infantry badge was, you had, I think you had to be in combat so many days in World War II to get it. But Bronze Stars or Silver Stars or any of those other things weren't as important to the common foot soldier as that combat infantry badge was. And Jones mentions in his World War II book, the nonfiction account there, that that was the only one that we would wear.
Yeah, and I have his combat infantryman's badge.
You know, it's interesting because we hear stories, and this, I can tell you a story from my own family. I had an uncle who passed away a couple of years ago who served in World War II as a gunner in the back of a Navy plane. And he won all manner of awards. And when he came home, he never flew again.
Mm-hmm.
But his family didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, like, tucked away way, 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 way back.
Yeah. I think there are things that keep reminding people, not only the nightmares and the memories, but I was down in Arthur, Illinois, with one of the members of our Marine Corps League here who was on Iwo Jima, not in Slats Trower, and he had a piece of shrapnel. And this was just a month or so ago, a piece of shrapnel working out of his finger that he had gotten on Iwo Jima in 1945.
Well, we're coming down on the time here. Before we go, I do want to know, Kaylee, what your thoughts are about the film based on your novel, A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries.
Well, I'm interested to see it again because I haven't seen it in a few years now. When it first came out, I saw it so many times at so many different events. And I couldn't separate. It's so strange. There's a sort of three-level thing going. One is the reality, which, of course, is history and is different for each person who remembers it. And then there's my novel, which was a false memoir. You know, I sort of structured it as a false memoir, inventing everything that I didn't know or couldn't remember. And then there's this film, which then took it from the memoir in the other direction back to nonfiction. You know, he copied the furniture, James Ivory copied the furniture in our house, you know, right down to the lamps, tea sets, everything. I mean, he copied all the furniture for the film. So it was not taken a step further away in film to yet another one step removed, but a step back toward memoir, which was very strange for me. And Kris Kristofferson so much reminded me of my father. We spent, you know, a month together down in on the set, and it was just a really strange experience. And I haven't seen the film in a few years. I think it's a very, very good film. It's a very unusual film for Merchant Ivory. It's not at all their typical fare, and I think that may have been a disservice to the film because people don't expect that kind of film from James Ivory. But I think it's a marvelous, very, very interesting film and very different than the book, very different from the book. My daughter's going to see it on Friday night. She's 9 years old. She'll be one day after her birthday, and she's never seen the film. So I'm really excited because Ray's two daughters and my daughter are going to see this film together.
That's
and
great.
They're right at the right age for it, I think. And so that's my audience. That's who I'm thrilled about seeing this movie with. You know, I'm really excited.
I wonder if you'll be watching the movie or watching your daughter.
I'm probably going to be watching my daughter.
Well, one of the things I wanted to add, if I've got time, Celeste,
sure.
is Roger Ebert is a lifetime member of the James Jones Society, and he gave it a thumbs up, the soldier's daughter, one of his thumbs up. And he says, if the parallels between this story and the growing up of Kaylee Jones are true ones, then James Jones was not just a good writer but a good man. And I think that speaks volumes about how people perceive this movie.
Yeah, and it's interesting because most people expect when they hear there's going to be a film, they expect some kind of horrible scandal, you know, a daddy dearest kind of story, you know, where it's going to be all about the, you know, dishing the dirt, you know, in the family. And really this is about what a nice daddy was, you know, in his own strange, funny way, his very military way in certain ways, you know. He was a terrific person.
Yeah. Let's squeeze in a listener now. We got a caller waiting to talk with the two of you in Chicago on line 4. Hi.
Briefly, speaking of pictures, the movie Pearl Harbor illustrated a point where the successful raid upon Pearl Harbor by the aircraft carrier planes were returning, and the captain of the ship turned to the admiral, who was in charge of the whole operation, and he said, Admiral, your operation was a complete success. And the admiral turned to him and said, no, the real success would have been for someone who could have prevented it. And we must now realize that the folly and irony of war is such that while Japan and Germany were our enemies, they have turned subsequently to become our allies. So we should do all we can to make sure that we don't make any enemies and we do have more allies.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, war is a terrible thing no matter what happens. And as, you know, it's Studs Terkel when he says the good war, you know, that's multi-layered too. You know, it is. In a sense, the good war, but that's also meant in an ironic sense. And there is really no such thing as a good war, but that was a war that I guess, as you said, had to be fought, and it's the last one that we've had where we really had to fight. The others are really, you know, political and economic, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We've got to wrap it up here. Before we go, just one more thought about stories. There are a number of books coming out now that are telling the stories of the soldiers of the Iraq War. I've got three of them with me in the studio here. Mm-hmm. We don't have time to talk about them too much. And also, thanks to the Internet, you can find people telling these stories almost in real time now. Any thoughts about the current situation and homecoming for...
We have a couple of Iraq veterans coming to the symposium. Water and Darkness was written by a young man who was in the first Iraq War in Desert Storm, who lives in Chicago, and he's going to be coming to the symposium. And then we have some other soldiers who just got back who got in touch with me and said, you know, I'm your father's books still are so relevant to the situation, and you know, they're going to be there, and I think, you know, if we can, it would be wonderful to ask them during the symposium what they think. I think, personally, that this is a disaster. I think this is the war. My husband and I marched against this war in the first march there was in New York City several years ago. We didn't believe for one second that there were weapons of mass destruction, and we thought we were getting ourselves into terrible trouble, and it looks like that's exactly what we did. I mean, we are in serious trouble. And it's horrible, frankly, because to me it's not about freedom, it's about oil. And I don't think anybody's life is worth losing an 18-year-old young man for oil. I don't.
I think a number of the writers that are coming back and writing stuff, it's a catharsis of sort, I think, for them in that respect. And I also think they want people to know, as I do, as any writer does, what it's really like. there. And we can sit back here in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and not even be aware of the effects of what's going on there. But I think these people want to share that with us and let us know what it is that they're going through.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. The 16th Annual Symposium of the James Jones Literary Society is this Friday and Saturday, the 10th and 11th of November at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. It will include showings of a number of films, including three feature films, adaptations of From Here to Eternity and The Thin Red Line. And the third film, which kicks off the symposium Friday evening, Ray, what time is that?
It's at 7:30.
Okay. A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries is the adaptation of Kaylee Jones's novel of the same title. For more information, where can people turn?
Turn to the News Gazette. We'll have an ad in tomorrow's paper,
okay.
The Virginia Theater, and their I don't remember the URL for that, but the Virginia Theater has information about that as well.
And the symposium is free and open to the public, but there is an admission charge for the three feature films that will be screened.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Ray, Kaylee, thank you very much for talking
with us. Thank you.